Well, I have to say, I'm a bit annoyed about this podcast because I didn't get to ask Matea nearly enough things that I wanted to. The time certainly just seemed to just run by. We had a great time talking. I don't even know how long I've known Matea, at least easily 10 years. She's a four-star eventer. She's a Grand Prix show jumper. She's a very experienced reproductive vet up in Queensland. And her and her partner Shane Davidson run a very successful breeding competition training operation up there near Toowoomba. But she's just all around a nice person, and we've been talking for ages about getting her on, and I was really glad we could make it happen just before the breeding season, got too hectic. So I hope you guys enjoy it.
APM Animal Health Equine Services provides comprehensive equine care across our network of dedicated equine and mixed practice clinics. We offer a diverse range of services to meet the needs of horse owners and enthusiasts, from the family pony to racehorses, equine athletes, and stud farms. Our knowledgeable team possess extensive experience in equine reproduction, surgery, foal and neonatal care, ambulatory and emergency services, advanced diagnostics and internal medicine. APM's dedicated, purpose-built equine centres are located in New South Wales at Agnes Banks and Scone, in the Victorian towns of Bendigo, Gippsland and Warrnambool, and in Queensland at Bow Desert. In addition, our network of mixed practice clinics in Western Australia, Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria and Tasmania provide ambulatory care for horses via our passionate and experienced veterinary teams. Innovation is the cornerstone of our commitment to delivering first-class veterinary care, exemplified by initiatives such as our foal ambulance operating across Bendigo and surrounds. Collaboration across our network of equine clinics ensures that every client receives the best available treatment and advice. APM's vet teams share a wealth of knowledge and experience that drives optimum outcomes for our equine clients. APM Animal Health's purpose is to enrich the lives of animals, people, and communities. We're committed to providing exceptional veterinary care in the regional communities our clinics are located. Find out more by visiting apm.com.au. Join us as we strive towards our vision of healthy animals and happy people.
Welcome to another episode of the Equestrian Hub podcast. Today's guest, all the way from Queensland, we have Matea Davidson. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
No problem at all. We've talked about it for a while. You wear a few different hats. You're a professional rider, you're a vet, you're a successful breeder of sport horses, and a mother of two. Sounds like you got a lot on your plate.
Yeah, the plate is pretty full at the moment, I would say, that's for sure. But it's interesting. There's lots of variety.
And we had to organize the podcast around the witching hour.
Yes, around witching hour, and we're in the start of breeding season, so it's September, so collected a stallion and I've been riding breakers and all that sort of fun stuff today. So it's certainly a mixed bag.
It sounds like it. Have you got any stallions of your own?
We do. So Shane rides a lovely young stallion that he's actually an embryo foal out of the World Cup mare Fairbanks Lulu. He had and is by the German Staccato. And I say German Staccato because obviously Prue and Craig also have a lovely Staccato. And he's 6 years old and he's just stepped up to futurity, and he's a lovely young horse. So we've got him, and then we've got the old fella who's sort of semi-retired, Fairbanks Cartago, who Shane took overseas many years ago, but he's about 24 now. So he's the wise old man in the at the property.
Yeah, that's right. Even Hugh Hefner has to retire from stud duties.
He doesn't want to, though, I can tell you. He's still pretty keen.
Yeah, how good.
Yeah.
Yeah, it seems like you ride a lot of horses that you've bred yourself and brought up to the ranch yourself. And you mentioned you're riding some of the breakers as well today. Is that something that's definitely been a part of your plan to produce them start to finish, or did you just find that? that was the best way to ensure a quality product?
Yeah, like I think we certainly, the reason why we were breeding horses at the beginning was so that we had horses for ourselves, because it wasn't going to be sustainable to keep buying them. And we wanted, you know, good bloodlines. And also, to be honest, the reason why I went to university was so that I could be able to, you know, run the stud and be able to manage the horses from a, you know, sports management point of view. So there was sort of a reason behind that. So that's what happens. And obviously we can't keep everything. So they get sold along the way. They get sold because, you know, we need to make money and to eat. And then some of them get sold because they may still be lovely horses, but just not quite good enough for, you know, top level competition. So they've still got a place in the world, and we move them along.
Yeah, absolutely. That's always, I guess, if you know them and you know them from such a young age, generally they're probably getting good handling too, and you can make sure anything that's a little bit on the trickier side gets that extra special attention early on, or you can sort of pinpoint, you know, where horses are going to be best suited early on. Is that right? Or does it sometimes they surprise you a little bit once you start them under saddle?
Yeah, no, I definitely think that that's right. And it's, you do get a feel, like, I think, especially when you wean them, like the ones that squeal when you wean them always seem to have a bit more personality. But yeah, they, I do think it certainly gives you a good idea just in terms of their reactions to things too. So, like, you know, have they got more the flight reaction? Have they got more the fight reaction? How are they with a group of horses? How do they take to new challenges? You know, are they sort of really bolshy and very confident, but maybe a bit more stubborn or a bit more standoffish, but seem to respond, you know, to going forward and travelling more easily. So I do think that that certainly helps. But, you know, we also get a lot of horses that we have to ride that we haven't started, and you're sort of dealing with them at whatever stage they're at in their career. Like, it could be a kid's horse that you're riding and it's 16 years old. Like, I had to do that the other day. There was a kid's horse and he'd sort of decided that he, you know, he was wanting to sort of pull the brakes, and he had enough, and he just needed a little bit of encouragement that, you know, he still had to continue with his job, and then he was happy to do it again. So, you know, we've all sort of ridden those horses, and certainly I still ride them when you're trying to help kids out or students out, just to get them on the straight and narrow again, I suppose.
I always say, don't get on the ponies, don't get on the ponies. And then every now and then, oh, I've got to get on this thing. It just, you know, they, you know, you don't want to say, oh, they're taking the piss, but they just learn. They're smart. They learn how to, you know, get the pressure off by doing the wrong thing, because then the kid will be like, I just stopped riding. But yeah, those little ones with little small necks, you know, they're easier to, and that, especially when they're a bit older, they're a bit set in their ways. They're pretty smart, some of them.
Oh, they are. And, you know, like you say, they're smart, and it doesn't take much for them to, you know, understand that they can have a little win and then they don't have to do anything. So I don't really blame them. They're just probably quite smart.
That's exactly right. Yeah, the kids need to just get a little bit smart, or not just kids, adults too. You know, yeah. We just need to be. And so you're based just outside of Toowoomba, is that right?
Yeah, so we're just between Toowoomba and Oakey. So a lot of people would know the great Reg Pascoe, who ran Oakey Veterinary Hospital for many, many years. He was one of the leading equine surgeons in the world. So that Oakey is just down the road. So we're between Oakey and Toowoomba. And we've been in Toowoomba since 2011. So just after the floods, we moved here. And because we were below the range when it flooded. And I actually really love it. It's a beautiful city, and it's getting quite big. There's some cracking restaurants. So if you ever want to have good Turkish cuisine, I think I've told you this, there's Sofra.
Turkish restaurant there.
Yeah, great. It's a nice, there's everything you need. It's a nice city without feeling like you're in like Brisbane or Sydney, that sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. A bit less hustle and bustle. So you mentioned you moved up there because you used to be down and below the range. Where did you grow up?
So I'm just a Brizzy girl. I was very suburban. My family are not horsey at all or rural at all. I'm the youngest of five kids. I'm the only one that rode. I went to school at an all-girls school in Brisbane and started riding because of a friend.
Yeah, so one of the friends from school got you into it.
Yeah, so it was actually primary school, and her dad started the Brisbane Polo Club. So he was a polo player. He's sadly passed away when we were in high school, but he used to play with and organise the games for like Packer and Michael King, and so we were just kids and went along and used to hop on the polo ponies at the end of the game and fang them around. It's great fun.
And what did your parents think of at this stage, like in your early teenage years? Did they think you were going to get over it, or, did you think, oh, this is just a phase, or?
Absolutely. Absolutely. They thought it was a face.
And what did you find? Did you think, oh, this is really nice, or did you want to do something else, or did you start to think back then, oh, I'd love to just do horses?
Yeah, I think I wanted to do horses. To be honest, I didn't even know that until I worked at Kevin McNabb's, because I did ride horses and I did a bit of interschool and that, but I'd been very sheltered from that world. It wasn't even like I didn't know that a yard like that existed. And this is back in the day before the internet, really. People didn't have websites. And unless you saw it in the good old horse magazine or horse deals, those people sort of didn't exist. Not meaning that they didn't, but if you weren't exposed to it directly, there's actually no way of knowing that they were there. Whereas now, social media just makes everything so accessible. So I suppose I actually didn't know when I was going through high school that people did this for a job. Like I genuinely didn't know that.
Yeah, it's I guess it's totally different now. The age of social media compared to before then, it was word of mouth. You'd have to sort of see someone and meet them to, go and do something with them. Or yeah, reading the old magazines. And so when you first got there, I guess that probably would have been pretty eye-opening learning all about this. And Kevin McNabb, an Olympic and or now who's now an Olympic and World Games representative eventer, very experienced rider, but back then he was obviously still talented. What was the things that you most had to get drilled into you or was most eye-opening for you when you first got there?
I think when I first got there, it was about having a system in place for the horses and even just down to like how a day worked at a stable like that, like in terms of, feeding them and working them and just, he had a lot of horses in work and being able to get them done in the day. But I think, they had a very consistent way that they trained all the horses. And just sort of understanding how that was that you incorporated that into their routine and letting the horse using exercises to school the horse. So not sort of trying to manufacture the jump or manufacture the way they were going. So definitely allowing the horse to develop themselves and I sort of suppose develop that fifth leg, if you want to call it, by the way that you're training them so they're very much in balance when they jump.
And how would you go about that? Would that include doing grids or like that?
Yeah, so they did do a lot of grids and even grids where you sort of trot in, so you're not placing them, so they have to actually watch it themselves. And I still do that a lot. I think that that's very useful because trotting a horse into something, you can't pick the spot for them. They have to pick it. And I think it also, as a rider, it teaches you to stay in balance with them because you then have to mirror your body to what the horse is doing. So it's a bit like closing your eyes when you come up to a jump. So I found that, I found that really useful. So I think they did a lot of that, and just getting the horses to jump out of their own balance, I suppose, especially from a young age, like doing it from the beginning, not trying to do that down the track.
And you probably, what was your horsepower like at this stage? Was it, this horse that you had as a teenager, or where did you go? What was your next step in getting an eventing horse? Where did you go looking for that, or did one fall into your lap?
Yeah, so I actually went to Kevin's without a horse, and I bought a young one off him. It was just one that was off the track, and I took it up to two star, and he actually won a few two stars. So that's basically what I had, but I wasn't at his all that long because I got into I think it was like 9 months or something, or 10 months, because I got accepted into vet science at uni. So if I hadn't have gotten accepted into that, I probably would have stayed. But because I got accepted and then I started the degree, so that's sort of how that happened.
And where did you go to university, and were you able to keep riding through uni?
Yeah, so I was actually doing, I was upgrading, I was trying to upgrade to get into vet when I was working for Kevin. So I was just doing a course, a science course by like distance. I got into vet and I still kept having lessons from Kevin and, would go there on the holidays and help out and that sort of thing. But just as I was finishing up working for Kevin, I met Shane. So that sort of worked in also. Apart from my private life or romantic life, I was getting help from him as well. So, and to answer your question, it was University of Queensland, so in St. Lucia, in Brisbane.
Is that a Gatton?
No, St. Lucia in Brisbane.
Ah, okay. So it's all sort of, it's not too far away, roughly in the same area. And was Shane, was he set up, like, was he a professional at that stage, or was he just getting into show jumping? What was his horsepower looking like?
Yeah, so he had actually just come back from Germany. So he'd been there, he'd just gotten back from the World Young Horse Championships with the stallion that they bred and took over. And prior to that, he'd been working in Germany for 7 years. So there, he was sort of just ramping up over here. He had quite a few nice young horses, so dressage and jumping horses, because they used to breed both, his family, so his parents. Yeah, so he had a number of young horses that he was starting and was quite busy with that.
Well, that certainly would have been helpful, I'm guessing. Is that when he was able to ride your horses while you're at uni, or give you a hand?
Yeah, so he it was actually a bit of a shock to the system starting vet because it's sort of like having a full-time job. Like we'd often start at 8 in the morning and would be there till 4 or 5 in the afternoon. And we moved in pretty soon after we'd been going out. So it was about 6 months after I started vet, I moved in with him, and he lived an hour and a half away from uni. So I had to commute to there. So I actually used to wake up at 4 in the morning, used to ride before I had to leave at 6:30. So I'd ride two horses, leave at 6:30, drive to uni, go to uni all day, and then come back and study, and then go to bed and do the whole thing again.
Rinse, repeat. Amazing what we do.
Yeah.
Serious course, different from the Bachelor of Political Science I did, which was like 4 hours in the classroom and about 12 hours at the bar each week. So what was, when you were doing vet, you know, I'm sure you would have, you know, enjoyed the horse section. What did you find the most difficult about doing vet, or, you know, besides the course load? And also what did you find was the best part about it?
I really liked the course. I just found it really hard. I didn't want to be there, to be honest. I didn't want to be there. I wanted to be riding, and it wasn't, you know, I just sort of finished riding at Kevin's and it was great and I was really enjoying it. And then the timing just, you know, I really was considering after the first 6 months not continuing, because I was probably pretty miserable, to be honest. But I'm glad I did in hindsight, because not just for the fact that I'm now a vet and it's actually come in very handy, but I think, you know, and it was something that I had to learn too, is to learn to sort of keep going through something that you don't necessarily want to do. Like, you've got to look at the bigger picture, because you know, being a vet has definitely made aspects of running this business easier, or more, I shouldn't say easier because it's not easier, but it makes it accessible, I suppose. I really had to push myself to complete something that I didn't want to do. So I think that's a skill in itself, actually finishing something that you start, even though maybe you don't want to.
How do I feel about doing a dressage test?
Just get to the end.
5 years, was it 5 years?
5 years, yeah, and I'd done 2 years of science before it, so I was at uni for 7 years.
All right, that's a slog. And then when you came out, did you have to go away and do practicals or residency kind of stuff at the towards the end of your course?
Yeah, so you sort of, you do that in your fifth year, and then I graduated and I went and worked at a mixed animal practice for a year, and then it got bought, and then there was a branch of that practice that was an equine practice. So then I sort of moved over and switched between doing small animals and equine, essentially. So, and a lot of that was repro work and just standard, like, you know, castration, stitch ups. And I have to say, like, I loved working as a vet. Like, I've always loved doing vet work. I've never not liked the work. So, you know, I think that that's probably what will keep me going in it for a long time. But sometimes the hours, you know, and it can be a mentally tough job sometimes.
Especially, well, I guess any kind of vet, but repro would probably be quite hard, because, you know, there's a lot of times where, you know, embryos don't take, or the semen doesn't work, or, you know, foals come out with legs on backwards. Am I on the right track there, with, especially with you doing repro? That sounds like it'd be pretty tough having to deal with that all the time.
Yeah, like, I think, you know, breeding work generally isn't an emergency. It's a planned procedure versus seeing a horse for colic and, you know, or broken leg or whatnot. So I suppose the expectations are often quite high, because if a horse is already sick with colic, it's not something that's happened as a result of you. It's something that you've been presented with to fix and try and help. Whereas, you know, sometimes there's the assumption that you can always get every mare and foal and that it will always work. And we just know statistically that that's not possible, because there's multiple things that come into play with that. And while I know that logically, you know, I like things to succeed, and I like to be able to succeed for the client. And for myself too. So when they don't get in foal, I do find that, you know, really frustrating, and I do sort of take the hit. So That's something that I'm still trying to work on.
Well, I always say, you know, you said logically, you know that, but I always say don't bring logic into the argument, because we're very much emotional beings, and we do, we put a lot of pressure on ourselves. What are some of the things that you found over the years that people could be mindful of in improve their success rate breeding with mares? Let's say, let's focus on the mare side of things, maybe nutrition, or in regards to dealing with the, you know, reproduction.
So nutrition is obviously important. You don't want them too skinny, and you don't want them too fat. I think the biggest thing is if a horse has a shiny coat, that's a great sign that they've got good health. So if they've got a, if their coat looks poor, obviously it's a bit difficult as they're coming out of winter and they'll often be a little bit woolly. But I mean, you can still tell if a coat is healthy. So a nice shiny mare is always, you know, indicative that that's a healthy horse. You want them on a rising plane of nutrition. So sort of putting on weight as you're putting them into foal. And, you know, there's a lot of things in terms of like a breeding soundness exam that you're looking at the mare. So do they have good conformation behind, and sort of being realistic with what your chances are. So, you know, you've got to take the mare into consideration. You've got to take the stallion and the semen in consideration. If it's fresh or chilled semen, you've got to take in the logistics of getting the semen shipped up, and things happen with that. And, you know, there's other things that just happen in terms of, especially with embryos, if people are wanting to compete, you can't sedate the mares, you know, if it's within 3 days, because then they've got the sedation in their system. So I suppose if there was an overarching sort of point I would try to emphasize, it would be to plan and really have a think about it and have a chat to your vet or someone that's experienced with breeding first, because it isn't as simple as just putting a mare in foal and getting a foal on the ground, because there's so many things that can go wrong, and it is a numbers game, and you know, again, statistically things will go wrong. So unfortunately, if you breed one horse a year, you could have that one that isn't going to make it for whatever reason. So that's what can be really hard for people to take, unfortunately.
Yeah, Ben, you mentioned the logistics of the whole thing, especially, I guess, in regards to, that'd be quite crucial with, say, frozen semen, you know, with your work that you do and the horses you're breeding. Like you mentioned, you've got that young stallion by the German Staccato, is that right?
Yeah.
Take that into consideration with frozen semen. And do you deal directly with the stallion or breeders in Germany, or is there a, go through?
Yeah, so we normally just go through like a dealer. So obviously there's multiple places in Australia. Holstein, Verband is one of them. But we also get semen, like we take on a lot of outside mares that aren't just coming to our stallion. So they might be cam drafting mares or, you know, whatever they are, stock horse. The semen for those stallions comes from all over. So often they're organising the frozen semen and it just arrives here from, you know, wherever it's being stored.
Let's go back to you're working in the vet practice, and tell, now that you're out working, you know, I'm sure the workload at uni was big, and now you're mentioning that the hours are quite big as well, you know, working as a, how was your career going at that time? You know, how did you manage to juggle riding and working?
Yeah, so I sort of, I was able to have more time when I finished actually uni to travel interstate because I and compete because I could ask for certain days off, and I'd often, you know, finish late on a Thursday night. I'd drive down to Scone early, you know, the next morning, get there, compete Saturday, Sunday, drive home Sunday and be at work early Monday morning. And a funny story once, like I think I'd gotten home from Scone at like 2 or 3 in the morning, and I then rocked up at work at 7 a.m. and didn't realise I wasn't even rostered on for that day. So I'd made sure I was there, and they were wondering why I turned up at the doorstep. Anyway, I went home and went to bed. So it was actually easier in a way, because what I'd found really hard through uni was to compete interstate. And that's what I really needed to do, because at that stage, we weren't actually having 3-day events in Queensland. And I needed to do those. Like, that was what was really hard. So to be able to actually, you know, go interstate, be able to do 3-day events, have access, go to, you know, all the venues that I hadn't been able to go to, all the courses. So it was actually those first 2 years out of uni that everything sort of could go full steam ahead, I suppose. Even though I was working, it was very different to being at uni.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the Queenslanders, they honestly, I feel like they do the most kilometres out of anyone going to shows, both eventing and show jumping. Like, obviously, Western Australians have to come the furthest, but they only do it once a year or once every couple of years. But, you know, you were down at Tamworth at the end of August, show jumping. You were in the Grand Prix in Winger last weekend, and I was thinking, far out, they're going up and down the freeway. What do you do, or what have you done over the years to keep yourself occupied, or do you find it really easy when you're driving, you just put some music on or what?
Yeah, I think that's actually changed as I've gotten older. So I think in the early days.
Why?
Say that again.
But it started out as cassettes and now it's Spotify.
I'm not that old. I did have cassettes when I was a kid though, yes. But by the time I had my license, it was CDs, thank you. So I think I probably was a music person. I've made a lot of my phone calls when I was in the car or in the truck, whatever. And then I started doing the whole audiobook thing. I have a really funny story of going interstate with Courtney to Courtney Stubberfield was a girl that worked for us for a couple of years, and I'd bought this audiobook, hadn't really, you know, paid any attention. It was CDs, and it ended up being a lot more steamy than what I was expecting. So it was an awkward car ride.
Well, that escalated quickly.
But it was, you know, it lightened the mood, and she hadn't been working for us very long, and I was like, you know, it just was one of those things. But now I like to listen to a lot of podcasts, actually. So, you know, I think that's something that evolves as you get older. I'm always interested in what makes people tick, I think. I think it's an interesting thing, because people often will say, you know, life isn't about work. And I don't agree that, it's not about work, but you work for a majority of your life. So I always think, if I meet someone, I always ask them what they do for a job, because it's what most of their life is. And I don't see it as being a negative thing, because I think it gives you an indication as to, you know, what sort of person they are, what makes them tick. And I suppose I am interested in that, and that's probably why I like coaching, because it's that psychology behind the person and why they're doing something. So I don't really know how I got onto that, but you're talking about podcasts, that's it, sorry, there you go.
But I thought I liked the direction you were going. So just before I ask you about coaching, Have you got any podcast recommendations for us? You know, you sound like you listen to a bit of Tim Ferriss or something like that.
One that I have really enjoyed listening to is called The Imperfects, which is Hugh Van Kylenberg.
Yeah, he's done a really good book on
So they interview like sports stars and actors and just range of people, and I find, you know, especially some of the early ones really interesting. So, and even just like high performance podcasts, coaching podcasts. So I think, and there is one with, and now you've asked me, I can't remember his name, Matthew McConaughey. He does some good ones.
Okay, he would be good. He's a good talker. Yeah, the Imperfects was recommended to me just only the other week. Have you read his book?
I haven't read the book, no.
Crying and then laughing and, you know, and then just, yeah, really, really good book. Some really powerful messages in that. So I can imagine he'd be good to listen to the podcast. Back to your coaching, you mentioned you like coaching and you're talking about that, you know, understanding their psychology. What are some things that you've really noticed in regards to the mental aspect of coaching that have helped you over the years to, you know, coach people?
I suppose it's one of those things when you start doing it, it's very much just about the task. Like, you know, you need to get the horse to do X, Y, and Z. So there is obviously that part of it that you need to know what you're talking about. In a way, that's the easy part, especially when you're teaching, you know, adult amateur riders and teenagers, and there's a lot of other things that you're having to deal with in terms of what they've got going on in their life and trying to sort of navigate that message to them to be able to, you know, have a few takeaways that they can then, you know, go home and continue on with what you've been talking about. So I suppose it's just trying to figure out how that person learns and actually what they want to get out of it. So those two things, because some people actually don't want to get better when they go to a lesson. They actually just want to, it's like a social thing, and that's absolutely okay. But I think, you know, you actually need to know that.
Yeah, that's right. And sometimes what they say is not what they mean.
No, and that's, you know, again, it's actually, I find it very different the way I coach in a clinic scenario. Like if you go and teach a range of people that you don't teach ordinarily is quite different to how I teach my students that, you know, you see every week, because, you know, it's a different relationship. You know how much you can push as well. Like you can often push a lot more when it's people that you're seeing on a regular basis, or you know what they sort of need. Whereas I do try to think of when you go and do clinics, it's, you know, you're there to motivate them and to make them feel sort of inspired about what they're doing and that they enjoy it and that they feel safe. I think that they're the main things.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. It's so much of it is, as I think we're realizing more and more, is that psychological aspect and how to get people to understand things is as important, if not more important, than the specific information on how to do the task, like you mentioned.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're you're driving up and down the East Coast doing all these events now, you know, and that's how we met, you know, when you were coming down into the great state of New South Wales to compete. But we see you doing a lot more shows now. You know, what precipitated that shift? You know, was it just the horses, or was it motherhood? Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, I think it's the horses. I've obviously always been involved with show jumping because Shane has ridden, you know, multiple horses to World Cup level. So I probably did more show jumping than your average event rider anyway, just because of that reason. I was lucky enough to get to ride Fairbanks Lulu over one World Cup track after Shane had, you know, produced her. So I got to, you know, hop on and jump around a meter 60 track and be sort of taught. It was the first time in my life I've ever ridden a schoolmaster as such. And she was amazing. And that really helped me to sort of understand what it was about, I suppose, or start to understand, I should say. I don't feel like I understand. I'm starting to. But it's definitely, it hasn't been a conscious decision. I just happen to have, say, the two horses I've got at Grand Prix or a World Cup level at the moment. One I used to event, and he was a very good eventer. And I broke him once and sort of tried to get him back going, and that wasn't going to work in the eventing circuit. So I decided to keep him as a show jumper, and he just kept going and getting better. And
got by Vivant, isn't he?
Yeah. So JB Vigilante by Vivant, and like he was a good eventer. I think the last event he won was it was down at Camden, and it was in the old one star, so two star, and he won it, and it was the national championships, I think they called it. So it was a pretty handy event horse. So I was pretty gutted when it wasn't an easy decision to make, but I sort of decided I'd prefer to have him as a jumper than break him again and not have him at all.
The Checkamore, that's the mare that you bred, is that right?
Yeah, so we bred Checkamore, and I started riding her. Shane and I broke her in, and she had a foal, which we commonly do with the mares. They'll get broken in and have a foal as like a four-year-old. And I was actually pregnant, and I was going down to the Australian Show Jumping Championships, and I didn't really have anything to take at the time, and Shane had just done, I think, like meters, maybe some meter tens with her, and she was down there, and I rode her at that competition, and then I just kept riding her after that. So, and she's very much more sort of suited to show jumping. She's can be a bit inconsistent in the contact, so she wouldn't be an ideal horse as a event horse. Probably, you know, just not the type you'd choose as an event horse. So that's how it worked out.
Well, it seems to have worked out well because, you know, both her, Checkamore, and JB Vigilante are jumping some seriously big tracks at the moment. How did you go? Just tell everyone how you went at Tamworth, and you were down at Wollongong as well.
Yeah, so it's been a pretty good season, actually, because I had, so my youngest son Lachlan's just turned 6 months old. So the first World Cup for this year was at Lara Pinta in April for me, and he was 6 weeks old. Checkamore, so Cindy we call her, she placed in that one. And Vigilante, I didn't actually get to start because he got cellulitis the night before. Anyway, he was fine 2 days later. But in answer to your question, so recently they were both placed at Tamworth and Waratah World Cups. And I think they were like fourth and seventh or fifth and, you know, something like that. And then Willinga Park that we were at on the weekend, Checkamore was fourth in the Grand Prix, and Vigi was just out of the placings. I made a bit of a mistake in the first round, so I had a rail and he had a rail, and it's the first time he's been out of the placings in a Grand Prix or a World Cup all year, actually.
Poor guy. Well, there was a couple ex-eventers by Vivant down there in the Grand Prix at Willinga. We had, was it also Rob Palm and Shane Rose? Also on Vivant ex-eventers.
Yeah, you're right. And there are actually there are a few ex-eventers in that class, like Rob Palm, who's show jumping, and Rachel Lee, who's show jumping. And certainly Shane Rose seems to be doing a bit more show jumping now too. So there were a few of us there. And the Vivants are very popular.
Yeah, I shouldn't say that Shane is an ex-eventer. That probably came out wrong. But, you know, with Virgil, he's just doing a bit more show jumping. I think it's pretty cool. You know, what he had 4 down at Waratah and then 3 down at Willinga. You know, I think they put up on their page the other day about it. And, you know, there probably isn't many other medal-winning eventers, you know, that have jumped around their horse around tracks like that. For Shane, you know, I think he's doing a lot more show jumping lately, and so that's really good for Shane, but also for the eventing team.
Yeah, and I think that it's something that so this is what happens when you have a 3-year-old.
Hello, mate.
Say hey, Charlie.
Hi, Charlie.
Yep. So you get... All right, you need...
it sounds like we're coming close to witching hour.
Let me just shut that door. Classic. Something you have to look forward to, Charlie.
No, I've got enough noise from the voices in my head. I don't need any other kids running around the room.
I think it's good with the I definitely think it's a good idea for the eventers to be doing more show jumping. Like I think it's good for your reaction time. I think you get to do more courses as well. It's something that you can also do more frequently with the horses without breaking them. I do have one young eventer. She's a 2-star and she's 6 years old, and I'd like to have a few more. There's also only so many hours in the day too. So having the 2 World Cup horses and her, plus whatever client's horses I have to ride and the vet work and that I have to do, there's actually only so many horses I can ride every day.
Well, like we said at the beginning, you know, it sounds like you've got a lot on your plate, and especially with that young fella just running in for a quick chat. How do you manage to get it all done? How much coffee do you drink? And how do you unwind? Like, it sounds like you don't get a lot of downtime. So how do you eventually unwind?
Yeah, there's not a lot of downtime. And I have to say this year there has been very little downtime with having Lockie, who, as I said, is 6 months old and Nick is 3 years old. I try to be as organised as I can. I think that that's key. If I'm not, then it just does not work. I have tried to, you know, I suppose be a bit more realistic with my expectations of things. Like, there's certainly mistakes, if we talk at it from a competition point of view, that I think I've made in courses where they'd probably not be as bad if I'd had a bit more sleep. Sleep definitely affects your reaction time. But I think at the end of the day, I'm just doing the best that I can. And Shane reminds me that it's still pretty good. But I think it's just sort of having that personality where you always want to do things better, I suppose. And it's not because I'm comparing myself to anyone else. If I think that something could have been done better, then it's, you know, something that I'm aiming to do next time. I suppose I don't really ever have the feeling that I go, yeah, that was perfect.
Yeah, no, you got high standards. It's both good and bad.
Yeah, it is both good and bad. And I think actually having kids has probably helped me put things in perspective a bit better, especially, you know, with horses and being able to handle the disappointment of when they break and that sort of thing a little bit better, because, you know, that's so disappointing when you've been, or you know, working towards something for a really long time, and being able to handle those disappointments, you know, it's vital. Otherwise, you just won't last in this sport. And I think that's the thing. It is a sport that you're in for a long time, and I never thought that I would have two horses at World Cup level or two horses that were competitive. But I suppose, you know, I always look at it as an opportunity. Like, I'm not going to knock it back and say, well, you know, it's not what I do. If I had a horse that was, you know, competing at Grand Prix level dressage, or I managed to do that, then I'd probably go with that too. I think, you know, I just enjoy doing things well, I suppose.
Yeah, no, I can see that, whether it's, yeah, eventing, show jumping, breeding. Has Nick got a pony? Yeah.
He does. He's got a very cool pony called Minty. Minty's quite old and a bit arthritic and a little bit cheeky, but he is a white, fluffy, little mini sheddy, not really sure what he is, but he's great. He's a dude. You just have to, just can't let him go, because if he gets loose, he's really a rat to catch. And he thinks it's a big game trying to catch him, like, you know, and he's...
Those little minis, I've had a few, and I reckon that minis are the worst to catch out of more in general than any other horse.
Yeah. Yeah, they are. But, look, he's just is so much fun to have around, and, you know, Nick doesn't really ride very much, but you sit him on it at a show and he sort of, I think he thinks that's just normal, like that's just part of life, that you sit on horses and ride them places. Like, it's like hopping in a car. It's just something everyone does.
Well, if someone was to, you know, give you some time off, give you a holiday, what would you want to do with the family?
Well, I think for the first couple of days, I'd just like to go and sleep. So that would be the first thing that I'd do, have some cocktails and have a sleep. But I love going to the beach. Like, you know, I just think there's something about being near the ocean. I always have liked Stradbroke Island. It's a beautiful place. And, you know, just somewhere that you can sort of turn off a little bit and be in the moment a little bit more, I suppose, because days go very quickly, you know, doing this job and with two little kids. So I think it's just being able to soak it all in a little bit more.
And when Mateo's lying on the beach there, what cocktail is she going to bring her?
I do like gin. I like fruity cocktails. Yeah.
No judgment.
What did you say?
No judgment here.
No judgment, no. But I am like a one-pot wonder, so I have to be a bit careful.
And just quickly, because I know I'm sure there'll be kids banging on your door in any moment. Have you got any favourite pieces of tack, you know, when you're riding at home or training, you know, like whether it be bits or something like that?
Yeah, like I think I'd love a good pair of jotties. I know that sounds really simple, but because you wear them all the time, and I think going back to the day, like jumpers have improved so much compared to, like, if I think even when I was working at Kevin's, the jumpers there were back then were pretty ordinary. So all the ones you could have access to in Australia, I don't know, there's probably better ones overseas, but we didn't have them here. So a good pair of jotties, because I've often got them on all day, and you want to be comfortable. So, you know, we're sponsored by Shockamole, and I've been wearing their jotties for years and I love them.
Yeah, I totally agree. The jodhpurs I wore at my first competition, or my first couple of competitions, this is probably about 2004, they were some old, you know, you see the photos of the old military riders where they go from the waist and they sort of flare out to like just above the neck. 20 centimetres out from your knee, then they cut back into your knee, and then there are lace-ups. But, like, the ends of the laces, like, nowadays they're just plastic on everything on laces, but these were, they're just, so vintage. But I was so naive. I didn't even know what was the fashion. And, you know, anyone that knows me knows I wear weird stuff. So I guess it started at a young age. Now, I was just wondering if there's any chance if we can get Nick back in here to ask him a quick question.
Yeah, he might have clothes on this time. Hang on a sec.
The video is not recorded, so it's all
Are you
going to
talk to him?
Come here. Sit on my lap. Say hello, Charlie.
Hello, Charlie.
Nick, who is your...
Well, you'll have to say it again. It cut out.
Who is your... Who is your favourite...
Who is your favourite horse?
Minty.
Minty.
Yeah. I've heard Minty's a pretty cool pony. Now, one other question, Nick. Who is scarier, Mum or Dad?
Daddy.
Yay!
Thank you.
That wasn't scripted at all.
I said thank you, Nick, and thank you very much, Matteo, for coming on. It's been having.
Yeah.
Bye.
Miss Tegan, I want to do my dinosaur book.
Okay. You take it to Miss Tegan. I'll be in there in a second. Hilarious.
Miss Tegan, I
want to. No, that was great. Thank you very much for coming on. I only just scratched the surface of what goes on in your day, really. Because you're very busy, a bit of a dynamic duo up there at Davidson Equestrian. And so if anyone is listening in and they want to see where they can get their hands on a nice young horse or maybe inquire about some lessons or some repro work, what's the best way for them to get in with you?
Probably just to Google Davidson Equestrian, and then all our contact details are there. And we're pretty easy to find on Facebook or Instagram.
Yeah, I agree with that. We'll put the link to that in the show notes. And I think definitely, you know, when I see you advertising your young horses or your stallions, you really put a lot of effort into making sure you get really good photos that really show off the athleticism of the horse. And especially in the social media age, you know, that's so important.
Yes, and I can't take any credit for that, but thank you.
No problem. Well, I hope you have a good rest of the evening, and thanks again for coming on.
Thanks, Charlie. Cheers.